Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the New Testament, the story of the redemption or the liberation of all humankind by Jesus coming from heaven to live, die, and rise from the dead so we might know how to get back to our heavenly home. I'm your host today, Monsignor Larry Moran, chaplain at the Carmelite Convent at South Terre Haute and John Paul II Catholic High at 12 Points in Terre Haute, Indiana. Our guest today and the author of this, with great research done from his many hundreds of books in his library, is Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High. We've been talking about the public life of Jesus, and we're in talking now about his home state, Galilee, which is at the top, Samaria in the middle, and Judea down the third section of the Holy Land. And as we know, Jesus was from Nazareth in Galilee. We talked about the Salt Sea, or the Asphalt Sea, that Lake of Galilee empties into the Dead Sea down in the south in Judea. So we're really talking right now again about this whole area that Jesus lived in. Some people, because it is so verdant and green, call it the green of Galilee. And I noticed that when I had an opportunity to be there. Well, Ron, let's go on about Galilee. Was a pretty populous place in those days, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Yes, it was. The Jewish historian Flavius Josephus reports that 240 cities and villages existed on the plain and around the lake itself, the smallest containing about 15,000 residents. Now, I think that's probably somewhat of an exaggeration, but there certainly were a lot of cities in Galilee. In fact, he lists 440 populous areas, including small towns, in all of Galilee throughout the whole province. And among some of the cities that were there was what was called the Decapolis, which literally means 10 cities in Greek, Greek-Roman cities, Scythopolis, Dion, Pella, Gadara, Hippos, Gerasa, Philadelphia, Damascus, Rephana, and Cananta. These were some of the cities, and there were others, which included Tiberias, Sepphoris, which was basically the capital of Galilee, Gabara, and Capernaum.
Okay. So what about the economy? How did people make a living in this area of Galilee that was so familiar to Jesus?
Well, as we said in the last session, the lake itself supported a major fishing industry. And we looked at that then. But Galilee was exceptionally fertile as well. And the weather was very agreeable to plant growth. So much so that it was a major agricultural region which rivaled Egypt in grains and cereals, wine, olive oil, and fruit such as walnuts, dates, and figs. Moreover, the fishing and agriculture industries, as well as the central location of Galilee, contributed to a thriving commerce. To expedite commerce, many roads and trade routes crossed the province. And because it was so accessible, in addition to Jews, the area possessed a mixed Gentile population consisting of Phoenicians, Arabs, Greeks, Romans, and actually dozens of others. For this reason, Galilee was not considered respectable by upright Judean Jews to the south, especially the scribes and Pharisees. These city-slickered Jerusalemites tended to look down on their agricultural northern neighbors as unsophisticated country bumpkins. The Judeans could always recognize Galileans by their peculiar accent, Not only were they considered stupid and unpolished, but because Galilee was a traditional hotbed of dissent, Judean Jews also considered them seditious as well.
Okay, a lot of the uprisings against Rome came out of Galilee. How about there was a, must have been a very diverse population what you're describing there. A lot of languages spoken at that time in the first century.
Yeah, yes, there were. By this time, Hebrew was a dead language, and it had been so for several hundred years, actually, much like Latin was to become a dead language in the European Middle Ages, except for the church and higher educational institutions. Hebrew was still the scriptural and liturgical language of the Jews, but it was no longer spoken by the Jewish people. And this is analogous to Latin being retained as the official language of the Catholic Church for centuries after it ceased being the language of the people. Aramaic was the tongue spoken by Jesus, which had been the language used by Palestinian Jews for several centuries. Aramaic was the official language of the Persian Empire, which had conquered the Babylonian Empire. And recall that the Hebrews had been carried off into captivity in 587 BC by the Babylonians. We discussed that in some detail in our series on the Old Testament. And Aramaic had been picked up by the Jews during the exile, and they brought it back with them. It was a closely related language to, it was a Semitic language and closely related to Hebrew. But Greek was the language used by non-Jewish scholars and educated people of the day.
Okay, why do you think that Jesus began his public ministry when he was around 28 or 30 in Galilee rather than in Judea, which is the central area, the capital of Jerusalem being there and the temple being there?
Well, probably one of the reasons he didn't start in Judea was because most of his enemies lived there. The scribes, the Pharisees, and the chief and high priest. And so it would have been much more difficult for him to have gained a foothold in Judea. More importantly, he began in Galilee to fulfill a prophecy. The Messiah had would begin in the territory of the tribes of Zebulun and Naphtali, where Capernaum was located. St. John quotes this prophecy as saying, quote, "The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, toward the sea, across the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. For those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned." This is a quote from Matthew 4:12. And Nazareth was located in Zebulun, as was Capernaum, which was right on the border of Naphtali. In addition, one commentator has said that Jesus chose Capernaum to be the base of his operations in Galilee because several of the 12 lived there, because it had a large mixed population of about 30,000. Also because it was centrally located, so that large numbers passed through there on the way to Jerusalem for the various annual festivals. Also because large crowds could easily be collected about it, and finally, it was conveniently located for crossing and recrossing the lake, which Jesus, of course, did on several occasions.
Ron, you've mentioned Capernaum several times. It's reported to be the headquarters of Jesus. Can you tell us something about this very important city at the northern end of the beautiful blue Sea of Galilee?
Capernaum of the first century AD was a very prosperous, very bustling commercial and governmental center on the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee, only about 2.5 miles southwest of where the Jordan River entered into the lake. It was Jesus' principal residence throughout most of his public life, so much so that Matthew calls it his city. This is in Matthew 4, chapter 4, 13, and in chapter 9 again. It was one of the main stations on the great caravan route that extended from Damascus to the Mediterranean ports all the way down to Egypt. The city possessed various markets, a customs house, a garrison of Roman soldiers, and a toll collection station from which numerous tax gatherers collected tax revenues from caravans en route. St. Matthew, of course, was one of those tax collectors before he became one of Jesus' disciples. A flow of traffic continually passed along the main streets of the city. Arab and Egyptian caravans, Jewish pilgrims, Roman soldiers, townspeople and couriers with news of the whole world passed through the city. And unlike the cities of the Decapolis, that is the 10 Greek Roman cities, which for the most part had Greek and Roman populations, the population of Capernaum consisted primarily of Jews who were native to the city or from different lakeside towns or from villages throughout Galilee. And it was here that Jesus called Matthew to be one of his apostles. And he worked many miracles, including the healing of Peter's mother-in-law there. For its unresponsiveness to his preaching, as we'll see later in the series, he cursed Capernaum before leaving the city for good. The Encyclopedic Dictionary of the Bible states that, quote, "So well was this prophetic curse fulfilled that shortly after the time of Christ, the place had declined to the status of an insignificant village, and today the very site is not definitely known." End of quote.
Is that right? I never heard that site wasn't definitely known. But they must try to make a good guess because they have a place at least they call Capernaum.
Yeah, there's a synagogue located there, a famous archaeological site, and probably some other buildings. And some believe this was not the original one that was there when Jesus lived there, that was one that was built on top of that one later on, but that's probable.
Well, say a word about that synagogue that is rather famous for people who go to the area.
Well, it was large enough to have its own synagogue, one of which Jesus frequently taught. It had been built by the centurion of a detachment of Roman soldiers who were quartered in the city during Jesus' time. And Jesus cured his servant, as John tells us in chapter 7. The building was constructed of the finest white limestone in Palestine, ornamented with sculptured reliefs of centaurs, lions, eagles, and palm trees, as well as vines. It was not only used for worship, but also as a gathering place for the Jewish teachers or rabbis to hold their conferences.
Okay, can you tell us how long Jesus' ministry lasted in Galilee, this beautiful, productive, magnificent cross-country, cross-centers of people coming from all areas around on their caravans? How long was Jesus in there in Galilean ministry?
Scholars have long debated the exact length of time of Jesus' ministry. The question is kind of difficult to answer because it depends on when his ministry began and how long his overall ministry lasted. As we discussed in an earlier session, one gets the impression from the Synoptic Gospels, that is Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that it lasted only about a year. But on the other hand, St. John recounts that Jesus attended three Passovers during his public ministry. And by this reasoning, it must have lasted over 2 years, maybe as long as 2.5 years. The first part of his ministry occurred in Galilee, as we've said, where he preaches, teaches in parables, forgives sins, heals the sick, drives out demons, raises the dead to life, and as we will see, he multiplies the loaves and fishes to feed the hungry crowds, and walks on water and calms the sea. But then after that, the focus of Jesus' ministry shifts to Judea.
Ron, there's a lot of controversy, and we don't go into all the details, but what about the dates when Jesus' public ministry actually started?
As I related in an earlier session, it's very difficult to tell the story of Jesus' public ministry because the Gospels were not intended to be a biography of Jesus' life. they were intended to tell us what he taught and what he did, and not necessarily in the chronological order in which he said and did them. The three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they tell a very similar story. But the events described in each don't always follow each other in the exact chronological order. And you'll find stories in one that you don't find in the other, those kind of things as well. Moreover, the synoptic Gospels vary considerably from John's Gospel on many points. And to relate all the stories about Jesus found in the Gospels, all four of the Gospels, it would take considerable time. So as we go through the rest of the series, we'll just cover and date some of the main ones. We said in an earlier session that biblical scholars have arrived at 778-779 AUC, meaning from the beginning of the founding of Rome, which that was the calendar back in those days, or what would be, to according to the Julian or the Gregorian calendars, the Christian calendars, 25-26 BC, as the probable dates of the beginning of Jesus' public ministry. The Catholic Encyclopedia, the 1911 edition, estimates that he was baptized in December of 1778, or 25 BC, which would mean that he would have been at least 30 at the time of his public ministry, assuming he was born between 6 and 4 BC. And we looked at all those matters in some detail earlier in the series. However, as I pointed out, for various reasons, I chose to follow the chronology of the historian Warren Carroll, who was the founder of Christendom College and author of numerous great Catholic books, a five-volume history of the Catholic Churches, I think is best known. Unfortunately, Dr. Carroll died within the last couple of months, but he believes that Jesus was 32 when he began his public life, and he makes a case for that, of course, in his books, which we won't go into, which would have been, by his and other scholars' calculation, the winter of 28 AD. So I basically am following that through this series. So he was probably baptized. Here's kind of a little summary here. He was probably baptized in December of 27 AD and would have returned to the Jordan River after his 40 days temptation in the wilderness in late January of 28 AD, or 781 AUC, or from the founding of Rome. John the Baptist urged two of his own followers to follow Jesus, whom he calls the Lamb of God. And after visiting Bethsaida and acquiring additional disciples, in addition to Andrew and John and Peter, the party of five or six then set out for Cana, a small town near Nazareth, to attend a wedding. And we've looked at all of those events. This was probably sometime in February of 28 AD. And when the wedding was over, apparently they went back to Capernaum for a few days and then went to Jerusalem for the first Passover of his public ministry. St. John tells us in his gospel that Jesus attended three Passovers during his public ministry. This journey was to be about 2 years before his Passover, when he offered himself at Calvary in replacement for the Passover lamb. And according to Carroll, the date of the first Passover was in April 28 AD, or 781 AUC, on the founding of Rome. After his encounter with Nicodemus, a story we also looked at, Jesus and his disciples traveled around Judea for a month or so. Then after hearing that John the Baptist had been imprisoned in Machaerus, Jesus headed back to Galilee by way of Samaria. And during his trip back to Galilee through Samaria, Jesus encountered the woman at Jacob's well. Carroll claims that the journey back to Galilee took place during May of 28 AD. So his ministry in Galilee would have begun in earnest in that month and year, according to the Roman calendar 781. After that, it's very difficult to follow Jesus' travels in Galilee for some time after this, but he would have taught in the synagogues along the seashore and the countryside until after calling Matthew to the apostleship. And he went to the Passover in April of that year.
So obviously, the exact dates are educated guesses.
Yes.
And we don't have to be worried about that it varies from situation to situation. We know Jesus did these things. We're Scholars are just trying to pinpoint a little better what time they happened. They don't question that they happened. Well, the Sermon on the Mount is probably the best known sermon ever given in history, and it was apparently during his early ministry in Galilee that Jesus gave this Sermon of the Beatitudes, or the Sermon on the Mount. Let's take a look at that very important event, Ron.
This is appropriate time, I think, to do that. He delivered the Sermon on the Mount in July of 28 A.D. Again, that's an educated guess, but it's based on some information. From a hillside near the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee, probably near Capernaum. He had early established his base of operations there. The sermon, it's a discourse that fills three chapters of Matthew's Gospel, Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. Although there's a much shorter version in Luke 6, chapter 6 as well. The Encyclopedic Dictionary of the Bible states that, quote, "The sermon is a summary of Jesus' teachings, and although many others were no doubt present, it was probably intended for his most intimate disciples, especially the 12. It includes the moral code of Christianity. It contains the 8 Beatitudes, describes the disciples as the salt of the earth, shows the new laws of completion and perfection of the old, condemns religious hypocrisy, and contains an instruction on prayer and the Our Father," end of quote. The Beatitudes are specific rewards that Jesus promises to those who perform certain good works. And those who heard the sermon knew that Jesus was a special man who taught with divine authority and not just another teacher. Matthew tells us that in chapter 7. He came to fulfill the law, not to replace it, so the sermon contains no new teachings, just refinements and clarifications of the old law. That is the law of Moses. His message as he went about preaching in Galilee was, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." Matthew tells us that in chapter 4, verse 17.
All right, tell us more, Ron, about what Jesus meant when he said he had come to fulfill the law of Moses, not to replace or destroy it.
According to Father John Hardin, whom we have quoted many times in this series, to make the connection between the Old and New Testament, quote, "St. Matthew went to great pains to recall the Sermon on the Mount, with its studied contrast with the ethics of the Old Law, or at least of most Jews at the time of Christ. Jesus began by insisting that he did not come to destroy the law of the prophets, but to fulfill it. Then he proceeded to lay down a standard of morality that marked for all time the cleavage with former days and the fulfillment of a long-awaited Holy One who would sanctify those who believed in his name." That is that quote. In this regard, Jesus said, "For truly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot, will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches men, so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. When he who does them and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." We found that in Matthew 18 and 19. What Jesus did in the Sermon on the Mount was to emphasize and to elaborate on the commandments of love found in the Mosaic Law, that is, love of God and love of neighbor. The first three commandments of the first tablet, we think of, you know, two tablets in the Ten Commandments, are oriented to love of God. And the seven of the second tablet refer to love of neighbor. Father Hardin goes on to say, I'll quote one little statement here of his, "Writing for the Jews, Matthew synthesized the Master's teachings in the Eight Beatitudes and climaxed them in the Lord's Prayer. Taken together, these norms of conduct introduced a new dimension into human culture, and quite alone warrant the conclusion that Jesus of Nazareth professed to be more than a human legislator. End of quote.
Can, Ron, you give us some specific cases where Jesus added to the law of Moses, didn't destroy it, but came to fulfill it?
Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, and I'll quote again a statement I quoted a while ago, "Think not that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches men, so shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But he who does them and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." And then immediately after that, this is the reason I quoted it again, immediately after that, Jesus proceeded to give instances where his new law fulfills the old, such as anger against one's neighbor is a violation against the commandment against killing, and that adultery in the heart is a violation of the commandment against adultery and fornication.
Okay, so Jesus took it out of just the act, which is seriously wrong, adultery or fornication, sexual relations with a person who's not one's husband or wife, but that Jesus took it in to our thinking that to lust after a woman would be to commit adultery in one's heart. So Jesus advanced to even thinking.
Yeah, that's a hard one for people to understand and to accept. You know, when you start thinking about things, Jesus was a great psychologist. People, the next thing they want to do is to do them, and unfortunately, all too often do.
And of course, it's probably important to say that temptation to adultery or fornication is obviously not a sin at all, but it's the willingly accepting the impulse or the thought or the temptation and giving into it mentally. It's like if I decided to murder a person and was planning to do so, and when I got there, for some reason, the police were surrounding the place and I couldn't murder the person, I had still committed murder in my heart. Because once I decide to do something, Jesus is telling us, that's where sin also comes from.
Of course, that would be a mortal sin, too.
Sure. Well, unfortunately, our time is given out already, Ron. To our listening audience, we say, may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.
Yes.